This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
So this is Going Green. I'm Asher, Asher Levin, and you're listening to the show. We're here today with John Quigley. So if you guys don't know what the show is, I guess you could go back and, or there's probably a description or something, but I go into conversations without knowing a whole lot about the subject. Jay, trusted producer on the show, writes all the questions. I do not see them before John, so okay. I have not looked at them. That's the gag on this thing. And we talk about life and hopefully try not to talk too much about the current administration so that we can stay on point with everything. Mm. John, but I know you very, very well. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people who are listening probably don't know you. Maybe they know some stuff you've done, but why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Okay, thanks, Asher. Appreciate it. Jay, thank you as well. I'm someone who's basically, I've spent my life working to speak truth to power, protect Mother Earth, transition our economy, our society into a sustainable future. So that's taken many forms, everything from working on the front lines, doing blockades, forest defense up in British Columbia, the Great Bear Rainforest, some urban tree sits here in Los Angeles, as well as working on a variety of media campaigns to move people towards renewable energy, dealing in Washington, lobbying in Washington, at the UN, just kind of whatever looked like it was the most effective next step to move the world in the right direction. And that's really been my true north, is will this ultimately lead us to a place that benefits the common good, the most people, and the planet? Because we are in a transition right now from a couple hundred years of industrialization, and now we're hitting the wall where we're seeing the negative impacts of that, and we have to make this big transition for our kids or their kids and future generations. So that's really what my whole career has been about. Some of the things that I've done have gotten, you know, a fair amount of notoriety, which we can talk about maybe along the way, but essentially the essence of it all is about that everyone is equal and that we as a species have a responsibility to see the consequences of our development and to adjust so that it benefits all life.
Okay, great. So what, before I look here at the questions, you know what I want to know, and I never asked you because we know each other, you know, socially, and we know each other through the board and stuff. What was your entry point into all the work that you do?
Hmm.
You know?
Well, it's a good question. I'll see if I can laser the response. For me, I grew up in a family where the idea of public service was celebrated. My dad was in the military. He was an admiral in the Navy. My oldest brother went to the Naval Academy. So this idea of that the most noble thing that you can do is work for the common good in different ways. And I took as a sign when I came of age that we were in a time of peace after the Vietnam War. And I took that as a sign that my role was to really work for peace and ultimately for what I saw as the most crucial thing, which was environmental sustainability as moving forward. And as I was, I just had a profound epiphany in my 20s as I was looking around and seeing what was happening with development, that we needed to act quickly to become more conscious of the way we built, the kind of energy we use, what we do with our waste, all of that. And it sort of dovetailed with the Time Planet of the Year issue in the late 80s. And then very soon after that, I connected in with the Earth Day 1990 effort. But it was the classic, I had a vision in the desert, actually. Right. I was working in the desert creatively, and just had a profound epiphany that this is what I wanted to do with my life, and that if I did this, then I would wake up every day feeling good about the person I looked in the mirror, you know, that I saw in the mirror.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we could start with these, and then if other stuff comes up, then other things will come up. Let me see. I'm going to do a quick scan here. How about this? Let's talk. Actually, you know what? I want to start with something that's really close to you, mm-hmm. which is the South Central Farm.
Mm.
You're currently working hard to save the South Central Farm.
Yes.
With the hashtag buy back the farm movement.
Mm-hmm.
How important are green spaces and urban farms for the city? And just a little background for some of our listeners. You have had a very personal connection with urban farms, and it's almost kind of a way that you've made a name for yourself, you know, early on in what you were doing with protecting certain areas that are in the middle of the city. You know, I would love for you to expand on not just how important green spaces and urban farms are for cities, but also this is something that I talked about recently with someone. How important parks are in and mixed use areas are for urban developments in cities.
Well, there is a growing body of research of the positive impact when people spend time in nature, in forest, in green space. And in central Los Angeles in particular, there are children who rarely ever spend any time other than maybe a tree planted in a sidewalk somewhere, who actually have the... a few years ago, I was involved in an effort to support a group that takes kids from central Los Angeles up to nature camps in the summer north of Los Angeles, and the profound impact it has on their lives. Because if all you see every day is concrete, and if all you see every day are cars and walls and all of that, you're living in a very limited world of possibility. So the healing aspects of green spaces, the sense of holistic health that can come from just spending time in nature. And then in the case of the South Central Farm, it also, it's a food desert, you know? So you're talking about providing organic food to people who are living in a food desert.
Well, I think, and also we should expand a little bit about the history of this.
Because yes.
I think it's really cool. And I think most people don't realize that in an area where it's mostly associated with, you know, 90s sort of crime and some of the more horrific things that happened, you know, with police brutality, and then also some of the music that's coming out of there, that there's this whole other thing that's been around for years before that and still around.
Right. And I think there are certain things that emerge organically and in nature, but also in the social fabric. And the South Central Farm is the best example of that I've ever seen, because it literally, it's in the Alameda Corridor, which is the dirtiest air corridor in California, I believe, certainly in Los Angeles, way over the federal limit of pollutants in the air. And there was this giant vacant lot there in the 80s that the city seized from a local developer to build an incinerator. Now, that incinerator was going to be right next to, on the other side of the street, that you have the Alameda Corridor, then you have this vacant lot that later became the farm. And then across the next street was a community. So that community rose up and said, hell no, you're not going to put an incinerator right next to our school. There's a school like half a block away or a block away. And the group Concerned Citizens of South Central was born, primarily African American organization that was led by Juanita Tate. So they rose up, and the land had been seized through eminent domain from the local developer. So when concerned citizens of South Central rose up, they defeated the plan to place the incinerator in their community, which was essentially an environmental justice and environmental racism issue. So then the land was just sitting there, and it's right across from the LA Regional Food Bank. So in 92, when the uprising happened, the riots, the LA Regional Food Bank went to then Mayor Tom Bradley and said, help us heal the city by allowing people to grow food on that land, and he said yes. So that was the birth of the South Central Farm. So over the course of 14 years, that became an elaborate farm that fed about 350 families and also provided food to others in the community through farmers markets.
And this is the type of stuff that you can't normally get.
Well, it was a combination. I mean, you know, there were some avocados and things you would normally expect, but also there was a lot of things like nopales and other types of cactus and an amazing assortment of traditional vegetables, tomatoes, carrots, avocados, but also some really specialized stuff. And it became a phenomenon. It became the largest urban farm in America. And it was, you know, there's two great things to the story. It was phenomenally successful as a farm, but as a social entity. You're talking about, as you said, you know, the stereotype of South Central is
right,
gangs exactly. And crime and all of that. You had a 14-acre area where a 7-year-old kid could run around all day and their parents would feel safe, that because they're just there with the plots and the farmers, you know, the garden plots and stuff like that. Also, from an environmental standpoint, I remember being across the street on a really hot day where it's about 100 degrees, and then you walk a half a block, walk onto the farm, and it was so lush, the temperature would drop like 15 degrees. So, I mean, there was a tangible.
You could actually feel it then.
You could feel it. You could feel it. You know, because with all that concrete on a hot day in that corridor, everything just gets amplified. But then you have that lush greenery from the farm. And it was an oasis. I mean, Joan Baez, when we were at the farm, she called it an oasis in a concrete jungle.
Right. I think it's really important to, you know, remember that communities need communal centers.
Right.
And the definition of a community is really, you know, the idea that there's something that unifies the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And green spaces are very, very important. And I think that they're the first thing to be demolished.
You know,
but they are the last connective tissue, you know, between your brothers and sisters and your neighbors and all that sort of stuff, even though it sounds kind of corny, but...
No, but it's true. I mean, right? and especially...
So what are you doing now with South Central?
Well,
now that we've done this...
The history. Well, yeah. Let me just finish off the history of Booby.
Okay.
So that was 2006. So what happened at that point is that the original developer went back to the city and said, hey, you seized my land to build this incinerator, but you never built the incinerator. So I want the land back. So they, in a backroom deal, they sold it to him at undervalue. And then he went about evicting the farmers. And at that point, I got a call from Julia Butterfly Hill asking if I would come, because I have a background as a tree sitter and a forest defender, if I would set up a tree sit for her and I at the farm. And we were going to do this encampment to raise money to buy the farm. So over 23 days, thousands and thousands of people came down to the farm. We were able to raise $16.3 million to buy the farm. But at the last minute, literally 30 minutes before we were going to have our press conference to announce that we had done it, the developer said that he wouldn't sell for $100 million to those people. And, you know, it was disappointing. The city leaders at the time, Mayor Villaraigosa, to me, it was a big black eye on the city, because it could have been a win-win-win for everyone. The developer got his money. So they came in with SWAT teams, evicted all of us. And then, you know, it's been going through a process all these years. The developer eventually sold it. And now there's a new owner, which is a conglomerate of Korean fast fashion companies, and they want to build a warehouse there. We went back.
Which would be even more toxins.
Exactly. Well, and that's really the flaw in their plan, is that it's already over the federal limit of exhaust and emissions, and now they want to add all these truck trips to that, the dirtiest air corridor in Los Angeles. And plus, we're the real estate situation right now in Los Angeles is there are hundreds of empty warehouse spaces.
Right.
So our argument is the only place that we can, you know, the last large open space near downtown is this area for this 14 acres. And they have literally hundreds of options of where they can place their warehouse. So we came back on the 10-year anniversary. For the first time, the farmers went back onto the land. We unfurled these giant letters that said "Aquí estamos" with a giant carrot that said, you know, it said, "We're still here." And it was such an incredible feeling to see the children who had been on the farm 20 years ago, 10 years ago, were now 30 years old. They had their own kids. One of them, her name's Rosa. She's now a professor at Occidental College. She's on citywide boards on health and nutrition. And we looked around and said, wow, we have a whole new generation of leadership. The farm is still here. Let's see if we can get it back. And so that's what we've been doing. And the response has been unbelievable.
So how can people get involved with this?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you can check out on Facebook, Bring Back SC Farm, or use the hashtag Buy Back the Farm. And the big thing right now is we are appealing, and we're launching a petition in the next couple of days to the company, asking them to be a hero for Los Angeles, to sell the farm back to us. And we've, you know, through back channels, some of the original funders have sent us signals that if we can make a willing buyer, that we'll be able to do it. So right now, it's all about getting Pima, which is the four companies involved are MISMI Jeans, Impact, Active Basic, and Pima. Poetry Fashion. So that's who we're appealing to, the Korean business community, really.
So all the Korean business owners on here.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, if anybody knows, you know, how to get to certain people, and then obviously, you know, you go to hashtag Buy Back the Farm,
right.
And then the Facebook, what is it again?
Bring Back SC Farm.
Bring Back SC Farm. Okay, let's move off of this. And then, yeah, no, it's better now.
It's better.
I don't know what's going on with it. We're having some sound difficulties.
I really think it's. I keep telling them
it's the mic, right?
It's that mic, and they keep saying, "No, it's not. You're just doing. Try this." And it's
all right. Well, we're gonna take a break for 1 second. We're gonna listen to stuff, and we'll come right back in.
Yeah, no, it's okay. We have.
Okay. Great. Yeah. What? Hi. Hi. Oh, great. Okay. All right. We're back in. So you can cut it back in. Okay, cool. So we had a little technical difficulty there, which allowed me to take a moment to take a break from our show. This will be our first ever foray into advertisement on Going Green. And we're just going to advertise for our own stuff on this one. So in about a month, a little over a month, about 5 weeks from now, Environmental Media Association is proud to announce our second annual event. We've had one event, the Emma Awards, which, John, you've been to quite a few times before.
Many times.
We've had that for 27 years. And this year is year one of a really exciting new event called Impact. Impact. So maybe we'll put some music behind that. I can't hear it yet, but I'm guessing that the producers are going to put some really cool music behind this. So Impact is a mix of activism, impact investment information, innovators, celebrities, all different types of people that are coming together to tell you how you can make an impact in our world moving forward. So the idea is for all of you out there, if you want to come out as you walk in, try to figure out how you can make a difference in the world today. And can you hear from literally the most important people in impact investment, which is essentially investing your morals with your dollars. We have incredible innovators that are going to be there. Some of the the largest names of the last 35 years in consumer products and tech companies. We have venture capitalists are going to be there. Politicians are going to be there. Celebrities are going to be there. And guess who else is going to be there? No, I am going to be there, but John Quigley is going to be there as well. And he's going to be on a forum discussing social activism, something you know quite a bit about. Yes. But we talked about South Central Farm. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other things we're going to talk about here too. But I think that, you know, one thing I'd love to talk to you about really quickly is you are quite a rebel rouser when it comes to your environmental missions. And there's not a lot of fear that goes into what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You kind of just go out there and do what needs to be done for the mission that you are setting out to do. So first of all, where did that sort of way of thinking come from? And secondly, has there ever been incident where you felt like maybe this time I went a little farther than I should have?
There may have been a few of those, mostly in the frontline days. I think for me, a lot of it came from when I was younger, looking at people who were a couple decades older than me and going, wow, how did they get, you know, they started out here and how did they get to where they are now? Meaning what I was perceiving as having compromised their ideals. And early on in this process for me, I came across a quote, "The only true aging is the erosion of your ideals." And I've really tried to live by that. And, you know, as you get older, you have different needs and stuff. And being able to differentiate between what is wisdom and what is selling out, to me, is the principal work of someone who wants to make the world a better place. I saw the urgency of the situation environmentally back to late 80s, early 90s, that we needed to move fast, and that the best way to do that, any great movement has at its forefront people who are willing to risk everything.
But when I describe you, you know, when you say, hey, what's John all about? I always think like you're almost like a superhero vigilante, you know, when it comes to environmentalism. Mm-hmm. What's the process of, okay, there's something going on in the rainforest, for example, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And I see the bat signal in the sky.
Right.
And, or the cue, right? And I'm going to devise a plan to do what I can do to really help make an actual difference in this particular issue. Like, what's the process?
Well, if you look at any one of those successful campaigns to save something that looked like it was lost, somewhere in the mix is someone who did something, could have been a simple act, but it essentially risked their well-being, their life, their freedom, their reputation. Almost always that's in there. And that could be as simple as up in Clackwit Sound, four people who rode a kayak across to an island that was about to be clear cut, and they stood knee deep in the water. And when you know, the loggers came with their machines, they simply refused to leave. And it was those four people who didn't know what was going to happen to them, didn't know if they were going to get beaten, didn't know if they were going to get arrested, didn't know what. And to this day, that incredible island in the middle of Clackwit Sound still has an ancient forest on it. And so after working on environmental issues, you know, in terms of promoting the ideas and all of that, there was something that happened in 1994, 95 that was significant that not that many people remember. But it was something called the Timber Salvage Rider, which was attached to the budget bill in Washington. And Al Gore would later say it was the biggest mistake of the first administration of Clinton Gore. And what it did is it made it illegal to protest the cutting of the last 60 plus stands of ancient forest in America. Not only that, it was unconstitutional, where you couldn't even challenge it in court. And that meant that the logging companies could use any kind of rationale of disease or potential fire to go and cut these last stands of forest. And they knew that the law was unconstitutional, but they knew that they could cut everything before the court case would be settled. And when I heard about that, I said, you know what? I need to just go. I just need to go put my body in between that. And there were, you know, there were a bunch of us who did. I went up to Oregon to a forest action camp, and that's how I got into this frontline defense stuff. And once you're in that world, first of all, you're around people who are incredibly courageous, who are willing to do things. And it was all based on nonviolence, at least the crew that I was a part of, for sure. But you start to hear stories like the story I just told up in Clackwood Sound, mm-hmm. where literally one person on one day doing one thing meant the difference between whether, you know, thousands of acres of ancient forest stayed alive. And so you get into
this is super interesting, and you're talking about this frontline defense,
right?
Maybe you can expand a little bit. You get in there. This is, you know, the storyteller in me. My mind is just racing. You
right.
walk in, you know. So how did you get recruited, first of all? And then what was that experience like?
Well, I had heard about it. I had been doing some activist work. You know, I had been doing activist work in different ways, but just not at that level. Right. Like here in Los Angeles, working with Rainforest Action Network sure. and some of these other groups about what was happening in the Amazon. So through some of those contacts, I heard about this forest action camp in Oregon, which it was the first time it was happening. It was some of the guys who had co-founded Earth First and also had been Greenpeace action trainers and stuff. And they had split off and created this thing called the Ruckus Society, which is based on nonviolent principles, but they wanted to pass on the tools of what they had learned about how to, you know, there's two things in this kind of activism. There are tactical actions, which is like where you literally stop the destruction, and there's symbolic actions. And the most powerful actions are ones that are both tactical and symbolic. So I learned about that. So I just decided I was at a point in life, you know, because of this timber salvage rider, that I wanted to go and risk it all. You know, I wanted to go and just do whatever I could do, because, you know, once 2,000-year-old, 1,500-year-old trees are gone, you know, they're gone for
right.
2,000 years. So that's, and so that's kind of how I've based my decisions is what is about to happen something that can regenerate quickly, or is it irreplaceable, essentially irreplaceable for the long, you know, past seven generations? So a lot of my work has been about going to the last of, whether it's in the Amazon or in the Great Bear Rainforest, and doing what I can do, because those sanctuaries, and this is a great story, I just told this a couple of days ago. There's a place in the Amazon, and you know this, Asher, because you yeah. helped produce a film about it for yeah. us, an Amazon watch. It's called the Yasuni. The Yasuni is the most biologically diverse place in the entire Amazon. And literally, I was in at a rainforest lodge the day before I went to the Yasuni. Beautiful, exquisite, amazing wonderland of Amazonian forest. Took a 14-hour boat ride to the Yasuni. And I was startled to see how it could get that much more magical. The colors, the diversity, you could literally see it in one day from what you would already think is the most magical right. place. So here's the thing about the Yasuni. It's one of the few places in the world that did not freeze during the Ice Age. And a lot of people, a lot of researchers and scientists believe that the entire Amazon basin, once the ice receded, was repopulated from the Yasuni. So if you think about that, saving these last sanctuaries of extreme mature nature, to me, was something worth dedicating my life to.
You know, I think a lot of people, and listen, this is even a bipartisan thing, because
right.
you know, that along with the litany of other insane things that are been thrown our way in the first month and change of the new administration. One was a bill to essentially take off all the protection of our national parks.
Right.
And out of all of these bills, The only one of these bills that was immediately pushed back was the Parks bill. Mm. And I think that's because what people forget is that being a conservationist is not a Republican or a Democrat right. thing. It's an American thing. You know, Americans came here, founded, you know, the American dream includes the big redwoods, Appalachian Mountains, and all, you know, all this sort
Yosemite.
Of, absolutely. Yeah. And so I think that there's something inherently frontier-esque about mm-hmm. protecting our land. Mm-hmm. And perhaps some of it has to do with what you're talking about in terms of the historical magnitude of a place like, you know, the Yosuni you know, some of these areas. And so I think it's really important. This is actually a good way to transition into to something that's a little bit more topical. Obviously, we currently are in an interesting mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. Just made reference to all the crazy things going on in our country. Mm-hmm. I don't need to belabor the point. People talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. But what I do believe has grown out of this and even started a little bit earlier last year was a sort of renewed sense of personal impact, personal spirit, mm. and activism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would imagine that in the early 90s, late 80s, when you first began your road as mm-hmm. as an environmentalist and as an activist, mm-hmm. you were faced with some similar things, because I'm aware, we're all aware, that the administration that you originally were dealing with was not exactly favorable.
Right.
Obviously the second half of the Clinton administration hit its groove a bit more, and you know, all the stuff sort of post 2000, regardless of what you want to say about, you know, Bush 2, wasn't as historically insane as some of the stuff that happened in the 80s and what we're being faced with now. Mm-hmm. So for all of these new young folks, mm-hmm. We have some new people on our board. We have a lot of young mm-hmm. people that mm-hmm. listen. You know, what I'd love to know is what you think about mm-hmm. this next generation of activists mm-hmm. and where they're going with things. And also, as there are, you were just talking about a symbolic win and a tactical win. Mm-hmm. Last winter, DAPL was obviously mm-hmm. something that was you know, and is still ongoing. It's mm-hmm. Standing Rock issues and Dakota mm-hmm. Access Pipeline. There, you know, in late December, there was a symbolic win. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, not a tactical win yet, because there's tons of stuff going on. So I guess this is a twofold question.
Right.
So part number one is, I'd love to know what you think about this sort of 2.0 activist, mm-hmm. environmental activist that is slowly blossoming. Mm-hmm. That you can see on Instagram feeds, mm-hmm. Facebook, and mm-hmm. everywhere. They're using social media, you mm-hmm. know. The second part is, you've been on the front line for quite a while now in Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. Where are we at with things, mm-hmm. and why is it okay if it doesn't happen the way we've all planned? You know, why is it not the end of the world, and why is this somewhat we still need to create a path? You mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm.
Well, first on the first subject, the sort of activist 2.0.
Yep.
Back in the day, we used to talk about, the victory isn't the headline. The victory is what happens on the ground. And I think the way that that applies, the headline helps you get to the victory on the ground, but it's not the end game. And I think it's the same way now with all these incredible tools that are going on that kind of cut both ways, you know. But there's certainly a way to engage far greater numbers of people. And I think it's important that it doesn't matter how many Facebook likes you have or how many retweets you have if the forest is cut, you know?
Right.
I mean, ultimately. So, and so keeping your eye on what the end game is, that it's only part of it, using those tools. And physical presence is important. And that's why Standing Rock has been... in some ways, an absolutely phenomenal success. There's been many pipeline protests. I worked heavily on the Keystone, which is the only other comparable one in terms of magnitude in recent times. And what happened at Standing Rock was due in large part to physical presence, to the physical activism of stopping the pipeline. And that brought about a unification amongst tribes. It became a rallying point, and that's why it's been so powerful. And that the power that's already been created, we need to harness and continue to grow that. Now, the tactical situation on the ground is a challenging one right now because of the way the election went. I believe that had we gotten the Democrat in this, we might have been able to continue the process that had been gone after under Obama. The Army Corps of Engineers had denied the permit. That would have given more time, because what the most effective form of activism right now is the economic activism, with Seattle pulling out of their relationship with Wells Fargo because of their investment in DAPL. And we're seeing this more and more. You're seeing it also about the administration, of how the brand is being hurt by people's shopping choices. So that is one of the most powerful ways. And even dating back to the great victory of the Great Bear Rainforest, what ultimately won that for us was when the New York Times said, we're not going to buy your paper anymore.
Right.
From British Columbia, because you're cutting ancient forests. So that market component is always crucial. So you need the full spectrum.
And I think it's important to note that, you know, just like Keystone before it, it gets harder every time. And with Keystone, and it gets hard, I mean, a positive way. You know, with Keystone, this was the very first pipeline, as you mentioned, that truly had some action, you know, oriented, on boots on the ground. There was a concert that you created. There was all, you know, so much press around it. Celebrities speaking out, normal people speaking out, social presence on different platforms. And it became a rallying cry where when Standing Rock began to happen, there was already kind of a blueprint. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this. And Cowboys and Indians Alliance was already there. A lot of the Native American tribes had already come together to a certain extent. The network had already started being built. What I mean by symbolic with this is you can't replicate this so many times on the negative side, meaning the people who are creating these pipeline junctions. At some point, every single loss that's taken on the other side builds that the activism to be stronger and stronger. Mm. And it becomes harder and harder to develop and harder to develop until there's just a moment where it's, you know what, we're just going to stop doing this altogether.
Right.
So,
and that's what we saw in the timber industry in British Columbia. There, it reached a point where the cost, both the social cost and the economic cost, was just too great.
Which is why it's so important to the divestment that's happening.
Exactly.
It is very, very important. And it might sound like, you know, sort of liberal hogwash, but if you really think about it, when a big city like Seattle, as you're talking about, take all their funds out of a large national bank, right? That is a huge loss. It's a hit.
It's right? a hit, and it signals to see we're dealing with an apparatus, this fossil fuel, you know, industrial complex that has been used to doing business relatively unimpeded. I mean, a few things here or there for a long, long time. So now what's happening is that the end is near for them. They're getting more desperate. That's why this fight first on Keystone and then especially on DAPL is so important. So even though we had that, what you called the symbolic victory in December, that actually wasn't a symbolic victory. That was actually in terms of the regulatory process, was a tactical victory because it delayed.
Right.
And that delay cost them money. And every time you cost them money, you have a greater chance of winning. And getting back to the end game now at Standing Rock, whether or not oil pumps through that pipeline underneath the river, if you pull back, it's just kind of like if you look at politics, you look at Bernie Sanders' campaign, just objectively, that is one of the greatest political campaigns in history from where it started to where it went to. It started out as a protest candidate, came very close to winning the nomination and potentially winning the presidency. in the process demonstrated an economic fundraising model for a presidential campaign that could revolutionize politics in America moving forward. So while there was tremendous disappointment from Bernie supporters, at a certain point when the results has occurred, you have to take the best of it and you have to move forward. You have
there
to keep
is a,
going.
Make no mistake, there is a transition in this country.
Right.
It is a transition from the way that people like to do business because they're used to it, mm-hmm. i.e. oil barons and Fortune 500 companies and lobbyists, mm-hmm. to the disrupted way that everybody who does business under the age of 50
right.
works. And that is green technology. That is the way that Bernie was able to support his campaign. Mm. That's the way that the media is going now. That's the way that all of the consumption is going. And so there is definitely like this sort of dance, this last dance, you know, of people that don't want to give up their job yet. And I think that, you know, just because you are a company that represents trillions of dollars and you're a CEO that may have $1 billion doesn't mean that you're just going to wave the white flag and say, okay, it's my time is over and you guys come in. So obviously this is a transitional phase. You're talking about how we've reached kind of, we're right at that tipping point, you know, mm-hmm. when it comes to energy usage and all these things. I think that it's, whether it's a life cycle, circle of life kind of thing, we're also at the tipping point of the other side where we can actually live sustainably with our energy usage without consuming in a way that negatively impacts the environment.
Right. And we just need an acceleration of that. And that it's all there now. It's not some futuristic thing.
No, not at all.
But what's, you know, with the subsidies, the fossil fuel subsidies and the way that the game has been played, that has been holding that off for quite some time. And the question right now, this transition is inevitable. The market will drive it at this point.
Right.
The question is how much damage will be done in the interim.
And that's why it's so important when you talk about, you know, the we're talking about this sort of new wave of activism.
Right.
It's so important for things like Standing Rock to continue to flourish, because the longer, like you said, from a tactical standpoint, the longer there are easements, the longer that things are suspended, the longer that the ball gets pushed farther away from the goal, the closer we get to coming up with the replacement, where companies will say, well, this is not worth it anymore. Let's just do this other thing. It's just like dollar for dollar.
Exactly. And that's happening. And again, you called it the last dance. And it's, you know, for those out there who, and there's been a huge awakening in the last month, obviously, with this transition of the administration. And someone called it, it's awakened the giant, the sleeping giant.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the over 50% of Americans who don't vote, or roughly 50% who don't vote, who basically go about their lives not really connected into how society is working. So now we have the potential to translate that awakened energy into effective action. And if that happens, which it looks like it's happening right now, and we need to keep pushing that and really cultivating that, then this acceleration over the next few years is going to be profound. And there are two things for someone who might be listening to this and said, you know what, I got to do something. Like, I got to get out of my comfort zone. Right. And I would say that's step one. And the people that I've respected most in my life, their drink of choice, their elixir of choice is courage. And I think for all of us, that's what we're faced with right now. It starts with courage. It's getting out of your comfort zone. And then choosing an effective path. You can't do it all. You've got to pick a slice, you know, and go for that. And I would say, if the things to focus on, just like early in my career, I was focused on ancient forest. Why these pipeline fights are so important is because there are water sources. It's oil versus water. On Keystone, it was the Ogallala Aquifer. In in Standing Rock, it's the Missouri River, the source of millions of people's drinking water and water source for irrigation and for crops. So those are highly leveraged things to put your energy into to stop the old system, which at this point has become a destructive system.
Right.
It creates convenience that we've become accustomed to in our comfort zone, but it is, make no mistake, it is a destructive system overall.
It's also a growing community, and I think that that's really important to note. There is a growing community, you know, that you said kind of started with the Bernie campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, now we saw the Standing Rock. And there was a little bit before in Keystone, but a growing community of people that are dedicated to understand that you can actually convert your activism to real change.
Right.
You know, and so when you mention, you know, all these things, is they're tangible in terms of let's get the band back together, let's keep going, let's keep doing this, you know. Right. And anybody who's out there that wants to, you know, really make a difference and continue this, there's a community now out there. It's not splintered. It's not decentralized. It seems like it's pretty, you know, one person knows another person and then that person's doing this.
And it's growing. It's definitely growing.
Right.
Well, and I think from a practical standpoint, it can be overwhelming. And so what I recommend to people is know what your toolkit is. And here's the spectrum. A great activist, Native activist, I remember she said, you know, signing a petition a day is my price for, you know, living on this planet. So figure out your mix, your palette of activism. I would highly recommend sometime this year putting yourself in a situation on the front line of something, meaning where there's actually some risk, could be arrest, whatever it is. Go to a protest a month. One of the great benefits, I was at the No DAPL protest the day of the executive order was signed at the federal building here in LA. It was one of the most incredible, feelings, because one of the things that we are sorely lacking in our country right now is real community. We're all behind these little electro screens most of the time. So to actually get out with hundreds of people, with his beautiful native group drumming, it was that feeling of connectedness to our neighbors. So look at it as a social event, even, because and one body showing up, how hundreds and thousands become hundreds and thousands is one person showing up, and that's you. So once a month, go to a protest. Once a year, risk yourself in an arrest situation or some kind of protest that is on the true front lines.
We're not endorsing this, but John is.
I'm endorsing it, and you can reach out to me if you want some tips on that. But then also on a daily basis, keep informed about what's going on. I mean, it's happening, and it takes 2 minutes usually, sometimes even less, to just click on something and sign a petition for to oppose this guy who's going to take over and gut the EPA if he gets in. I mean, what's happening in the administration right now is they're basically putting people in place that are opposed to doing the job of what those agencies were set up to do. And particularly on the EPA, it's just, potentially disastrous.
And look, it's starting to blow up in their faces. So
it is.
It's not like all these people, are just going to push their way in.
Right.
I don't think, other than the questionable education czar that we now have, I don't know how many others have even been approved yet.
Well, Tillerson got in. You know, having the CEO of Exxon as our Secretary of State is troubling. But
the point is, there's a lot more that are still in limbo, is my point. I think there's still like 10.
Yeah. Well, tomorrow Pruitt for EPA is the vote. I just got that. And, the thing is that a lot of these organizations, like I just got a text from the Sierra Club about this vote tomorrow. If you just sign up for this text list, it's very easy to stay involved. So think of like one online action a day that you can do, a petition or whatever to move things along. And then go to one protest a month and then find the thing that will really inspire you. Like, I know so many people who came to Standing Rock who it was a life-changing experience for them, because you see what's real when it gets down to the basics, like the future of our water versus the short-term profit of a few people who are using a militarized police force to enforce their economic profit move. You just go, wow, okay, this is what's really going on this planet all over the place. And we're just all, you know, on Netflix and, you know, on our computers, and we're all doing our thing in our comfortable lives. But in the end, we're all going to come face to face with it. Right now, it's in North Dakota. I know, you know, that's the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in North Dakota. But where we worked in Nebraska, it's Neely, you know, right? Yeah, Neely, Nebraska. It's conservative, Christian, Republican farmers,
right?
Whose family farm is threatened by tar sand spills on their farm, which is a part of the Sandhills. There's no cleaning that up if that happens. So now that this election's happened, they're laying awake at night worried about their family farm again. So it doesn't matter who you are, what race, religion, color, any of that. It comes down to, we're in a big transition. The people who have a lot of the money, and that is being driven by this pattern of fossil fuel production that has been going on, you know, 150 years, something like that. They want to squeeze the last little bits out of that. And we need to make sure that they don't destroy our water sources in the process, you know, and this is without even having the conversation about climate change. This is just about basic resources, water, drinking water, water for our food and things like that.
Also, climate change is too much of a blanket term. Today, we've already seen the implications of climate change. And what you're talking about, John, is climate change.
Right.
You know, when your community has a disaster, when there's hurricanes, when there's oil spills, when your water is being threatened, these are changes to your environment. You can call them whatever you want, climate change or environmental justice issues, whatever it is. It's all the same thing, because ultimately the climate will change based on the actions that are happening. It might be uncomfortable for 150 people now. It'll be very uncomfortable for 150,000 people, you know, in 5 years.
Right. Well, and language does matter. I mean, you know, the technical concept of climate change in terms of global negotiation and all that is what's happening in the atmosphere and the rising of the seas and all of that, and the changes in weather patterns. And language, I think, is really critical in all of this, because it's been used to divide us so often. You know, this idea of left and right, progressive and conservative. And we used to talk 20 years ago about the same, it's the same root word for conservative as it is for conservation.
Right.
And that's why I believe that the new movement that will emerge is something, who knows, maybe it'll be called essentialism or basicivity or something. It will be about something more elemental and basic than any of these concepts of ideological differences. And that's what I saw in Nebraska. You had these conservative Christian Republican farmers and ranchers working with Occupy style Native Americans, all united because of water, land, and food. And I believe that there's going to be a transformation and a reconfiguring of the political calculus, because more and more people are going to be finding the common ground about the basic building blocks of life than the way they're currently positioned. And I think if we emerge out of this implosion that's happening right now with this new administration, with a much broader coalition that is united about the future based on these building blocks of life, then we could enter into a phenomenal new green age, you know, of equity. I mean, like the dream. But it's going to come because the strength, and it's so interesting, the same power that I see in an indigenous warrior deep in the Amazon that is fighting to protect that forest, I see that same strength and courage in Art and Helen Tandarup on their farm in Neely, Nebraska. And the common thread between the two is they both work the land every single day. And that is the hope that I have, because there are a lot of those people out there.
Right.
And we need to support them.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones who are leading this.
Definitely. All right. So we are running long, but I'm going to, I want to ask this question because this is very specific to you, John. Mm-hmm. Through your company, Spectral Q, you've created over 150 human aerial art images. You actually coined the phrase aerial art. Mm-hmm. What's your goal with these photos? And second part of the question, what is the largest photo you have ever organized?
Well, the largest photo, and I think we're up getting close to 250 now in terms of numbers of images. But, you know, the goal was always that there are so many communities at risk that do not have the resources to advertise or get their message out another way. And I was also reaching a point from my frontline activist days where I realized that other people can hang banners, do tree sits and stuff, but I have, you know, a creative background that maybe I could do something different. And I in the early 90s, we were doing an event with thousands of kids cleaning up a beach. And I thought, well, what if we had them spell out a message to the adults to clean up LA? And so we did it, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done, you know, hurting all those kids. But it was very successful as a communicator. We did it for Earth Day in 1994. And so that led to other people asking me to do it. And over time, it just took off. And what it is, it's a tool that mainstream media respects because it requires precision. And the largest number of people that I've ever done is a little over 6,000 with students and teachers actually here in Los Angeles. The largest image was the world's largest crop art, which was done in a cornfield in Nebraska on the Keystone Pipeline route, the intersection point with the Ponca Trail of Tears. But generally, I work in a range of, you know, 1,000, couple thousand people. If it's extremely remote, you know, might be 500 or less, because it's, and then I've done a few mixed media installations, like doing the melting Vitruvian Man, the Da Vinci near the North Pole. That I did, that was quite a sort of technical feat.
And where can people see this stuff?
Well, they could go to spectralq.com and then also just Google my name and Spectral Q. A lot of stuff will come up.
The people listening have probably seen some of your work before. Obviously, you were on the cover of the New York Times for COP21, right?
COP21, and in fact, there's a short documentary, 20-minute documentary that's going to be screening at Cinequest next in like 2 weeks, and also here at the LA Independent Film Festival. That is we did the first public event after the bombings, before the terrorist bombings in Paris during COP21. And with the Eiffel Tower in the background, and that tells the story of those. But that's one of the most famous images for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about level of difficulty, I think one of the other things that people don't realize is this isn't like, you're not in like a studio, a soundstage.
No.
So there's tons of intangibles. Every time is a different thing. And I even my mom was describing to me in Dakota.
Oh, the Standing Rock, yeah.
Standing Rock that you guys... This you had to do to pull this off while there were like tanks and
right, yeah. All the militarized police force was right there, staged with their LRAD machine and stuff. And it's always different. Like in Paris, you know, since it was the first large public event after the bombings, we were dealing with the collective fear of another attack.
Right.
While we were gathering, and you know, in Standing Rock, that was a surreal situation because you have these beautiful water protectors. And that particular day, there was a big women's action led by women that your mom was part of. And then you have, I mean, these guys who look like they should be in the Iraq war or like fighting ISIS or something, with these big, this sound weapon that they had pointed at all of these people who are praying for the protection of the water. And it's, when you look at that and you go, this is happening in America, where public funds are being used to guard the private profits of this oil company, you know, that now our new president actually has a stake in, right, which he says he sold off, but we haven't been able to confirm that.
Right.
And then you go, wow, this is like the army is being used against the citizens of the United States who are, right, saying we want this to happen. And it's just, when you see that, it's so clearly wrong. It's so clearly the wrong way to go for what we always thought America was about. And I think that there were a lot of brave people who have gone to Standing Rock and have really suffered from that. And so we did two pieces there, two of these aerial pieces, and that one with your mom was right at the front line. And, you know, it was to help a young woman named Red Fawn, who's still in prison on charges that everyone thinks are fraudulent charges. Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is all fascinating. I'm trying to see if there's anything else that we need to go over. I think it seems like we've covered a lot of it. So, John, you know, closing thoughts. You're going to be at Impact,
yes,
at our summit, which I did a fake commercial for in the middle of the podcast.
Hey.
And you'll be there sitting on a panel with some other folks talking about activism, social media, mm-hmm, and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
You've kind of already given a really great roadmap to the next generation on this. So is there anything else that you want people to know before we go over and out here?
I would just advocate again that, you know, clicktivism is great, using your computer, your smartphone to move things along, to educate people. But there is no substitute for literally placing your body, whether it's going to a protest or going to the front line somewhere. You will be empowered. You will be transformed. You will rediscover a deeper well of your inner courage. And I highly recommend that you all take that opportunity to get turned back onto life at a level that it's hard to imagine until you do it. So as well as doing all of those other things, get out physically. Physical presence is the greatest tool we have to be able to affect change, and use it wisely.
Great. All right. Well, we'll talk to you guys next week. Hopefully none of you take John's advice too seriously and get arrested. We will talk to you soon again. John, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Asher.
And
great to talk.
Thank you.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.